And now on BBC Radio 4, DJ and Grammy Award-winning filmmaker Don Letts examines the life and music of the reggae singer Peter Tosh.
Peter Tosh was the Malcolm X to Bob Marley's Martin Luther King. One was an arouser and the other was a healer. But Peter was much more on the side of militancy.
His songs have been recorded by Eric Clapton, Peter Gabriel, Jackson Browne, Ben Harper, Chrissie Hynde from The Pretenders, and Jerry Garcia of The Grateful Dead, Sinead O'Connor.
Peter was adored as a revolutionary in Jamaica. He was so charismatic, and he was saying very much what the people thought.
Peter Tosh was not your average rock star, and as a person, you probably won't even like him. He could be arrogant, unpleasant, and intimidating. But for me, he was also a completely awe-inspiring performer, a revolutionary who stood up for the equal rights of the Jamaican poor and black people all over the world. They always call Bob Marley the reggae rebel, but Peter Tosh was far more militant and political than Bob ever was. His uncompromising attitude often caused controversy and landed him in serious trouble. And as you'll hear, his life could sometimes be as brutal as the way it ended. Born in October 1944, Peter Tosh grew up in poverty. Roger Steffens is a reggae historian who met and interviewed Peter many times.
He grew up out in the sticks in the bush in Savannah, Lamar. He never knew a father. He was raised by an aunt for the most part. And he was churchical. He began singing in choirs when he was a tiny boy. He made a guitar out of wire and a sardine can and taught himself to play by watching an older man who actually had a guitar.
Wayne Jobson is a radio DJ and producer of the 1992 Peter Tosh film, Red X.
I think with him growing up in Jamaica during the colonial days, in the 50s and so, it was, and as Peter said, you never saw a black school teacher or a black preacher or a black bank manager or anything like that. It was all English people who came down and took the big jobs. And therefore, you know, eventually you would want to rebel against this, especially with the church, where he was forced to go to church, you know, 2-3 times a week. And every day he was singing, "Oh Lord, wash me and I'll be as white as snow." You can't oppress anybody worse than that, you know? And so, you know, Peter said it was like apartheid in those days.
Aged just 15, Peter left home to make his fortune in the Jamaican capital of Kingston. He ended up in the slums of Trenchtown, where he soon became friends with Bunny Livingston and Bob Marley. The three boys formed the Wailing Wailers, a vocal harmony trio. With no money, they had to practice in the local church, but were soon able to get it together to release their first record. Here's Peter talking in a 1983 BBC interview.
I was the first one in the group who played music. I used to play my guitar. I used to play the keyboards. I taught Bob to play guitar and I taught Bonnie to play guitar because it was a part of making your music perfect, seen? And in those times, it's like we had a good voice, but we wasn't creating music that much. It was just singing people's song and singing people's song, and the people been telling us that we sound good, why don't go to the studio? So we got together once and we did some recording, recorded the first one, which was Simmer Down, and they loved it. It sold well.
In 1964, Simmer Down hit the number one spot. It signaled the beginning of local success for the trio. The Wailers' music was good time ska, but Peter began to steer the band towards a more political agenda. Peter Tosh biographer, John Missouri.
even from songs, you know, that they were covering back in the early days. Like, for example, when the Wailers first met and first started hanging out together in Trenchtown, this is, what, 62, 63, he was singing songs like Go Tell It on the Mountain.
Go tell it on the mountain.
Which were connected to the civil rights movement in America. So Peter was actually thinking along those lines from a very early stage.
Alongside his Wailers career, Peter also recorded as a solo artist. His songs became even more political, with tracks like Arise Black, Hush, Tries and Convicts, Christopher Columbus, Sir Francis Drake and Vasco da Gama for crimes against black people. One of his best-known songs is 400 Years, later recorded by the Wailers, which laments 400 years of white oppression.
400 years.
Political element to the music, Peter was also responsible for bringing the Rastafari religion to the band. Biographer John Missouri.
Bob decided to go to America, join his mother, raise some money on a new footing. He left Peter and Bunny behind in Jamaica and assured Coxon that they had the talent, they had what it took to actually continue the Wailers' music and keep on having hits, which they done. One of the songs they recorded whilst Bob was away was Rasta Shook Them Up, which was in the summer of 1966. And it was written directly after Emperor Haile Selassie had visited Jamaica. And that's the point where the Rasta element came into the Wailers songs. And it was Peter who introduced it.
Everybody was jumping and the shaking there.
After Bob's return to Jamaica, the Wailers got working with top producer Lee Scratch Perry. In 1972, they signed to Island Records, an international independent label ran by a white Jamaican called Chris Blackwell. They released two landmark reggae albums, Catch a Fire and Burning, which featured classic protest songs such as this, written by Bob and Peter.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
In 1974, Eric Clapton hit the American number one spot with the Wailers' song I Shot the Sheriff. The band was suddenly thrust into the international spotlight. Island Records boss Chris Blackwell moved to capitalize on the exposure and made the decision to make Bob the star of the band. The change of direction didn't go down well with Peter. Financial disagreements made the situation even worse. Reggae historian Roger Steffens.
Peter did not like Chris Blackwell. He quit the Wailers because they were promised in 1973, after the release of Catch a Fire, that if they came to England and did a series of one-night stands and recorded the second album, their tour expenses would be covered by Chris Blackwell. And at the end of the tour, they each got £100 and a bill for £40,000 that Blackwell said the Wailers owed him. The effect was Bunny Wailer quit on the spot and said, no longer will I trade one part of White Man's Babylon for another. And within a few months, Peter Tosh had quit the group too. He told me once, if him black show me how him black, and if him well show me one thing that is well with him, no man him white worst.
Peter signed to Columbia Records and threw himself into his solo career. His first post-Wailers album was Legalize It. Released in 1976, its central theme was one of his favourite subjects, marijuana.
Legalize it. Don't criticize it.
He did this song, Legalize It, which put it all on the line like no one had ever done before. It was the most blatant endorsement of marijuana yet heard in Jamaica. And of course, it was banned by both radio stations in Jamaica. So the way he responded was by taking out a big box ad in the Gleaner, the daily newspaper, and printing the lyrics so that the whole island knew what he was talking about.
Peter saw marijuana as a sacrament, essential to practicing Rastafari. Here's his assistant, Paul Scott.
In his, say, living room, you would have maybe two or three different type of herb. I only say, Paul, when I get up in the morning, I smoke this one. Lunchtime, I smoke this one. When I'm going to bed, I smoke this one. So I'd ask him, I'd say, well, what's the difference? He said, this one gets me up. This one keeps me going, meditating throughout the day. And this one, bedtime, puts me to sleep. They weren't labeled or anything. He knew what was what just by looking at them.
Legalize it, yeah, yeah. That's the best thing you can do.
At the time in Jamaica, singing a song praising marijuana was highly risky, as being caught in possession resulted in lengthy, hard labor prison sentences. But Peter immediately connected with the nation's poor, as marijuana was smoked recreationally and used medicinally by a large section of Jamaica's working class. In 1975 and 76, you couldn't go anywhere without hearing that song, whether it be Jamaica or Britain. It was a huge breakthrough moment for Peter. The following year, he released Equal Rights, an album dedicated to human rights and political equity.
Equal rights and justice.
Equal Rights is definitely Peter's greatest album and maybe the greatest reggae album ever.
Reggae DJ?
Testament. Every song on it is a classic. It's just like, at that time, everybody was saying peace and love, and Peter was like, I don't want no peace and equal rights until the people can live properly and until there's no, not that kind of a, you know, sufferation and holding people down as there was in Jamaica at the time and around the world. Peter was just like, I'm a revolutionary and I'm not going to say I don't want war. I do want war until the people can get the equal rights.
We are going to fight, 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 fight against apartheid. We got to fight, 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 fight against apartheid.
Equal rights themes centered on the black struggle in Africa. It was a bold statement from Peter because back in 1976, apartheid. His records were hitting the top 40 in the UK and America, but Peter wasn't happy. Although his music was similar in style to Bob Marley's, he wasn't getting the same exposure. In contrast, Bob had reached number 8 in the US charts with the Rastaman Vibration album. I asked Peter Tosh biographer John Mazzouri why that was.
He didn't make those media-friendly songs, those mainstream songs that Bob wrote. I mean, it's difficult to imagine Peter Tosh writing Three Little Birds or Is This Love? I think it was just that he had far more serious things on his mind. His agenda was altogether different.
Yeah, but he had some serious issues with people skills, didn't he? I mean, let's be honest.
Yes, indeed. In fact, in the course of doing this book, and you talk to people, and a surprising number of people didn't like him and found him very abrasive, found him rude, found him arrogant.
Peter was notoriously difficult to get on with. I remember in the late 70s, John Lydon, journalist Vivian Goldman, and yours truly went out to meet Peter in Jamaica. Vivian was allowed in, but he made John and me wait in the car, branding us heathens. I never did figure out why. Vivian didn't get on much better either.
I don't think I've ever had as many arguments with anybody in my life as I did with Peter Tosh. I remember once I was interviewing him. He was like, women are inferior to men. I was like, why is that? You know, oh, look at the docks. If you go down to the docks, a woman can't pick up a heavy bag and carry it the same way a man can. And there was, you know, there was quite embedded in Rasta anyway, certain things for women at their periods to be regarded as unclean. But he was really into it. Oh, you know, are you having your period? Should you be in the room with me now? I was like, excuse me, I'm here as a working professional, matey.
But that's not to say he couldn't be wickedly funny too. Roger Steffens.
For me, the best part of Peter Tosh's humor came out in his deconstruction of the language. He called his manager his damager, his producer was his reducer. The organizers were agonizers. Organization was an agonization. He called Christopher Columbus Christ Thief Cum Robus. The prime minister became the crime minister. The judge was the grudge. Western shrivelization. He called the Queen of England Queen Ear Lies a Bitch.
Both these sides of Peter's personality came out in the extreme at the One Love Peace concert in April of 1978. It was a 30,000 capacity show in Kingston, headlined by Bob Marley. Peter was one of the support acts. Jamaica's two warring political parties, the PNP and JLP, were in attendance to endorse a truce. It was to end gangland violence, which was threatening to turn into civil war. Bob Marley famously used the occasion to get the two opposing political leaders on stage to shake hands. Peter Tosh chose to do something entirely different. Here's Peter's keyboard player, Robbie Lynn.
Well, it was highly anticipated what might or might not have happened. Nobody knew for sure what Peter was going to bring that night, because but they knew he was going to do something strange and unusual. I think Peter decided that this was the night that he was going to make an effort to prove a point to everybody, you know, what he was all about.
It was an extraordinary piece of oratory, such as I have never seen before, and I don't know whether I ever will again. The power, the passion, the scalding, scathing anger, always expressed with this sort of rapier irony.
Peter spent over 40 minutes cussing the police and government over the legalization of marijuana and how the corruption of the state was oppressing the poor. Here's Wayne Jobson.
People went crazy. You know, the people loved it because this was their hero who was speaking up for them for the first time. You know, as kind of poet for the poor, Peter was spreading the message that the people wanted, which they had no way, because at the time, people of Jamaica had no voice. You know what I mean? There was no way to really, of them to, you know, tell their troubles. And Peter was spokesman for them.
Peter had been in trouble with the Jamaican authorities many times, either for protesting or smoking marijuana. He also suffered several beatings at the hands of the police. But after his One Love Peace concert tirade, he was a marked man. Weeks later, the police got their revenge outside a Kingston recording studio.
I saw when it started, and I was there, I was standing, and he wasn't bothering anybody. He probably had a little spliff in his hand, you know, but he wasn't bothering anybody. He wasn't out in the road doing it, you know, that's nothing new. Mm-hmm. And he was approached by probably one or two plainclothes policemen, and they started to get physical with him. He resisted. He tried to fight his way back. And then he was literally swarmed.
I mean, it was really, really sad. The amount of blows that they gave him with batons and this and that and that and that.
The police station was like a 5-minute walk away, and they literally, you know, took him physically, walked him to the police station, and he was taken into a room, and, you know, the sounds coming out of that room were not pleasant. You know, they had all sort of things on him, and he you know, in his desperation, he tried to escape through a window.
He told me 7 cops beat him for an hour and a half in a jail cell until he made it appear that he himself had died. He rolled his eyes up into the back of his head, and that's the only reason they stopped beating him. That's when they broke his skull open. You can see the pictures where you can see his brain.
It was not nice, to be honest. You know, we could only stand up outside and do nothing. Right. And I also recall Bob Marley coming there, because when word got to Bob, he came personally.
When Bob saw the condition that Peter was in, bleeding from the head like on the floor, he wept.
Peter suffered from the injuries for the rest of his life. As a result, he became even more angry and difficult to deal with than ever before. There was a silver lining, though. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were both at the One Love Peace concert and were so impressed with Peter's performance, they signed him to Rolling Stones Records. It was a new opportunity for international exposure. The resulting album was 1978's Bush Doctor, featuring Keith Richards on guitar. Mick Jagger also made an appearance on Peter's cover of The Temptations' Don't Look Back. If you just put your hand in mine, we're gonna leave all our troubles behind. Gonna walk, don't ride. Two more albums came out on Rolling Stones Records. Mystic Man in 1979 and Wanted, Dread and Alive in 1981. The Stones took Peter on a US tour, securing his profile as an international rock star. But the relationship began to sour after only a few years. Peter thought that Mick and Keith weren't promoting his albums enough and was outraged when they presented him with a bill for touring costs. He hijacked Keith Richards' Jamaican mansion as compensation, and Keith had to call in the cops to eject him. The Rolling Stones partnership came to an abrupt end. And then, on May the 11th, 1981, there was more bad news. Peter's childhood friend, Bob Marley, had died from cancer.
When Bob passed, I did an interview with Peter shortly after. And I said, "Is there anything you want people to know about you?" And he said, "They say I am the new king of reggae, but that is not true. There is nothing new about me." Which is so perfectly boasty and typical of Peter. And he turned off an awful lot of the Wailers fans by his antagonistic attitude toward Bob when Bob died. He didn't have much good to say about Bob at all. He hurt himself with the reggae public because of that.
With Bob gone, reggae's number one spot was up for grabs, but no one, Peter included, was ever to claim it. Without Bob, reggae seemed rudderless, and its popularity waned. After leaving the Rolling Stones, Peter Tosh signed to Capitol Records, releasing the Mama Africa album in 1983. It featured a cover of Johnny B. Goode, which scraped the lower reaches of the American Top 50. And then Peter disappeared for nearly 4 years. Some people said that the fallout from his police beating gave him unbearable migraines, making it impossible for him to work. A new album didn't materialize until 1987. No Nuclear War was a striking return to form. It was smart, sharp, and packed with uncompromising songs such as Come Together and Fight Apartheid. A US tour was booked, but Peter Tosh would never play again, because on the 11th of September 1987, he was brutally murdered. Since he found money and fame, Peter often gave to the poor in Jamaica. An old Trenchtown friend of Peter and Bob's called Lepo was one such person. The historian Isaac Ferguson.
People close to him, his wife, have told me that he was helping Lepo, and he had bought him an ice cone machine to help him get a little business going. He had bought him a mattress when he came out of prison to help him. Some of these guys, and from the criminal underworld, to be quite frank, and they would come around more successful guys like a Peter or a Bob or a Dennis Brown and so on. And they would expect normal that these guys would show them a little bit and help them here and there. And if these guys don't help them, they anger. They figure, well, you leave your own people behind.
Here's Wayne Jobson.
Peter would give him, you know, $50 or $100 or whatever. But Lepo didn't want this. He wanted big money. So he kept on and kept asking for more and more money. And what happened was that Peter had gone on the radio in Jamaica and said, "Oh, I'm suing EMI Records and I'm going to get $100 million from EMI Records.
I mean, that's a crazy statement to make. When you live in Jamaica and, you know, there's so many poor people and there's so many gangsters that if they think you have 100 million, they're coming to kill you. So Lepo and another guy went up to just basically rob him.
Peter was at home with his girlfriend Marlene and four friends. Lepo and two other gunmen burst their way into the house, demanding money. Peter's assistant, Paul.
He didn't have any money and they approached him physically. The guy came up with his gun and started to shove him. And one of them said, let's chop his head off. And they went for a machete and approached him and he just started to defend himself. And they shot him, they shot Free Eye, they shot Maroots. Marlene was shot in her head.
Radio DJ Free Eye and Peter Tosh were killed instantly. Four out of the six survived, including his girlfriend Marlene and his drummer Santa Davis.
It's not something that's easy to talk about, so there's something that happened, and I don't want to remember my bridging in that kind of, it's hard, it's hard, I cope with it, I cope with it, and it's just one of them tragedy where you say it could have been prevented, but because of greed, greedy people, because the same people who he was fighting for, right? Fighting for equal rights and justice for. That's the same type of people who came and do that horrific damage,
Lepo was caught and convicted for murder. He was sentenced to death, which was later commuted to life imprisonment. Jamaica lost another hero and the world one of the most revolutionary musicians in the history of pop. The reason I love Peter Tosh, aside from the wealth of classic songs he left behind, is that he was more than just a pop star. He truly believed in equal rights and justice, and I would place him right up there with Bob Marley and John Lennon as someone who used music as a tool for social change. I'll leave the last word to his friend, the historian Isaac Ferguson.
He had values. He was brutally honest. He was brave enough to be honest when others are not brave enough to be honest. He was brave enough to stand the consequences of being honest. So that, to me, is what sets Peter apart and is his greatest accomplishment. Being Peter Tosh is his greatest accomplishment.
If you wanna live, you better treat me good.
I'm in no bluntly. You don't go through 1/5 of the tribulation with either truth. As I know.
Don Letts was examining the life and music of the reggae singer Peter Tosh. A Rise Black Man was produced by James Hale.